Well, this seems like old times. Mainly because Reverend Lynn is sitting right there. And many of you don't know this, but a long time ago, when her freshman year, first semester, she was a student in my class. Whoa. So, I'm Joe Paoletti. My pronouns are she, her, and hers. I retired from the University of Maryland 2 years ago. And when Carrie mentioned this topic for the summer to me, I said, oh, I could talk about that. My work and my life at church, and it all combines, and yeah, I could do that. This turned out to be so hard. But anyway. And of course, I started by taking liberties with Robert Frost's Road Not Taken. Many roads led through a yellow wood. To the casual eye, they were distinct. But as I traveled mile by mile, they merged and widened. Sometimes I wandered, sometimes I followed, sometimes I led. Sometimes I walked alone, sometimes in a multitude, sometimes in total darkness, and sometimes a beacon lit the way. So this is a story about a journey. I could turn it into a story about two roads, like Robert Frost did, one professional and one spiritual, but that's not how life's journeys actually work. Because the traveler, me in this case, is moving along many paths simultaneously. Today I'm going to keep it simple, just describing my professional and intellectual journeys have been shaped by my spiritual life. First, I'm going to lay out my professional path, the work I've done, and how and why. And then I'm going to overlay the story with the ways in which becoming a Unitarian Universalist transformed my work. You might see your own experience in mine. That wouldn't surprise me, because I don't think my story is unique. Here goes. First, the professional me. I usually describe myself as a fashion historian. I research and write about how people have dressed in the past and about its cultural meaning. My specialty is clothing and gender, which I began studying back in the 1970s. Yeah, it's a long time. Most of my published works are about gender expression in American clothing, ranging from the history of the business suit to how pink and blue became gendered colors to the nuances of dress codes. The story of that body of work can't be reduced to just publications, sources, and citations, CV material. I began my career in one field, the clothing and textiles branch of home economics, and ended it in another, the blend of humanities and social science known as American Studies. That shift was imposed on me by the elimination of the textiles department at the University of Maryland in 1993. So it wasn't voluntary, and it wasn't easy. It actually forced me to reassess the focus of my work, my methods, and my potential audience. At some point early in that process, I realized how similar this was to my becoming a UU. Of course, it wasn't sudden institutional change that pushed me away from mainstream Protestant churches 20 years earlier. It was somewhat voluntary, though frankly unwanted. If I had had my druthers at the time, I would have been able to stay comfortably in that familiar belief system. But I'd never really accepted the Trinity. And by the time I was in seventh grade confirmation class, I had rejected the idea that my Jewish friends were going to hell. The more I learned about the world, the less I identified as a Christian or even religious. Finding this congregation in 1982 gave me the opportunity to reclaim my spirituality, not by adopting a new creed, but by searching and exploring. Best of all, I didn't have to travel alone. Now, I've sometimes joked that American Studies is the secular version of Unitarian Universalism. That's for the American Studies majors in the room. It was organized by scholars who found the disciplinary orthodoxies of history, sociology, and literature departments too constraining. It attracts students and researchers whose interests are eclectic, even eccentric. Learning to, as they say, do American Studies means exploring many theories and methods and then crafting your own approach to answer your own questions. Sound familiar? My experience as a seeker in this community of seekers turned out to be invaluable in helping me to make the transition to my new department. But there are two big differences between UUCSS and my new department. First, even back in 1993, my workplace was much less diverse than this congregation, particularly in terms of sexual orientation and gender identity. Second, there was no social interaction among my colleagues. In fact, there was hardly any interaction among us at all except during meetings, which most of you know I detest. Gradually, UUCSS became the community where I not only formed my closest friendships and my spiritual practice, but the place where I could listen, learn, and think about the cultural dimensions of gender. Not as theoretical constructs, but personal experiences. And that, to borrow a phrase from Robert Frost, has made all the difference. Many people who become researchers are drawn to focus on problems that call out to us. In my case, the itch I had to scratch was sexism. My work asked questions about masculinity and femininity, about gender roles and stereotypes, about how the clothes we wear shape and limit identity expression. But as a novice academic, I had fallen into the common trap of obscuring my personal interest behind cautious, unemotional language in order to appear properly objective. But then I signed up for Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, the adult religious education curriculum that posed the question, how would your life be different if you'd been taught to believe that God was a woman? Not long after, the women in the class organized the first women's retreat, now an annual event that I rarely miss. Attending those retreats and cultivating relationships with so many women helped me tangle and then retangle sex, gender, sexual orientation in ways that enriched me spiritually and also provided insights that gradually transformed my scholarship. Here, unfortunately, I need to digress into an explanation of my work, and I'll try to keep it short. We're talking about 40 years of stuff. The relationship between gender and culture has a history. And an important part of my work has been helping to read beliefs about gender, sex, and sexual orientation in the clothes we wear, especially in how we dress our children. My research had convinced me already that the late 19th century was a transition period between a time when sex and gender were not considered separate and the beginning of an era when the new science of psychology was starting to distinguish the two and trying to understand the causes of homosexuality. Before then, being male was the same as being masculine. Not only that, but masculinity and femininity were seen as adult characteristics, closely tied to adult sexuality. This helped me explain the ways that children were dressed. Babies and toddlers were only superficially male and female, so it would have been wrong to dress them like little men and women. A baby was dressed like a baby, in long white dresses that transformed them into little sexless cherubs. School-age boys and girls were still not dressed as adults, because to push them prematurely into men's and women's clothing was to make them too curious about adult sexuality. Freudian psychology changed all this, eventually convincing parents that children needed to notice and understand sexual differences in order to properly identify with same-sex parents. Homosexuality, the Freudians argued, resulted from misidentification. The solution was to dress boys and girls differently earlier. Bye-bye white baby dresses, hello pink and blue. Not until the 1950s was gender separated from biological sex. And the person responsible for this notion was a truly problematic character. I actually got pushback from people when I put him in my first book saying, do you know who this guy is? It's like, yeah, I know who this guy is. He's the guy who introduced the idea of gender as something other than having to do with language. His name is John Money, Dr. John Money of Johns Hopkins University. You might have heard of him. He was the guy who pioneered operations on intersex babies that he claimed successfully turned them into happy, well-adjusted boys and girls, usually boys, because those operations are easier. Just think about it. He explained his apparent success by claiming that gender, a term that he promoted, the use of gender as separate from sex, was entirely cultural and could be taught. If you took a college psychology course in the 1970s or 80s, as I did, that's what you learned. Unfortunately, as his little patients grew to adulthood, they were not happy, well-adjusted adults. One rather famously committed suicide after writing a memoir in which he condemned Money and discredited his claims. But Money's sex-gender dichotomy has survived as common knowledge. How many times have you heard that sex is biology, gender is cultural? One problem with this nature-nurture binary is that early childhood behaviors that conform to stereotypes, little girls like dolls better than cars, for example, is seen as nature. Prenatal testing made it possible for this stereotyping to anticipate the child's arrival by 20 weeks and start decorating the nursery. Since the mid-1980s, when sonograms started becoming common, toy departments, Happy Meals, and kids' clothing became so divided along gender lines that neutral options practically disappeared, despite the fact that in the same few decades, neuroscientists and evolutionary biologists have discovered that children learn cultural patterns like gender differences much earlier than commonly thought, just as they're learning language months before they say their first word. Another problem with the strict nature versus nurture model is that sexual orientation was usually tied to gender, nurture, not nature, which meant that it could be prevented or cured through therapy. Here comes the weirdest part of my research saga. So I need a bigger drink of water. As I was realizing all of this, I was writing and publishing a bunch of articles about how changing notions of gender could be seen in children's fashions. All the time, dancing around the homophobic, misogynistic, patriarchal elephant in the room. Or maybe elephants. I don't know if it's one elephant or three. In fact, at the time that my first department was being eliminated, the book I was working on was a history of American children's clothing, an illustrated survey of boys' and girls' fashion since the colonial period. There were going to be a few short sections about interesting side topics, including one about the history of pink and blue. But that was it. Why? Well, for one thing, my imagined audience at that time was other fashion historians, especially my colleagues in museums and historical societies who needed help identifying and exhibiting the children's clothing in their collections. But the bigger problem, probably the real problem, was that I was uncertain about how to write about the gender issues, and also not sure how that museum audience would respond to such a controversial topic. My fear only got worse when I shifted into American studies and found myself in a completely different environment, one where historical surveys had given way to cultural analysis, and where people wrote in dense, jargon-filled, theory-driven prose. Everything about that first book was suddenly wrong. Oh, it doesn't exist, by the way. In case you want to go looking for it. Being part of this community was key to shifting my focus to the people wearing the clothing. I gradually became a gender scholar who studies fashion, which changed everything from the questions I was asking to the way that I write about the answers that I find. I've learned more about class, race, gender, age, and their intersections here than I ever did from any amount of reading or conference presentations. This includes deep one-on-one conversations at the women's retreat, but also leading the middle school sexuality education class. Really getting to know a diverse group of people and discuss issues of identity in an open and trusting atmosphere has helped me see sex and gender orientation and gender expression not as abstractions, but as the personal, complicated, lived realities that they are. It's also evident after nearly four decades here that this is as feminist an environment as any gender studies department, but without the jargon. To be able to discuss issues around gender in everyday language has helped me write for a general audience. You have forced me to make myself clear. But my debt is even greater than that. Our principles express values that tell me what to do with that knowledge, affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. So you see, each Sunday when this community pledges itself to the endless search for truth, those aren't empty words to me. It's a reminder to use the values we share and the insights I have gained by being here to make sure my work is true and that it matters. The musical selections today may seem random, but they aren't. They express my conviction that by being part of this community, by getting to know you, I have learned to see life from many sides. And this has helped me not only on my personal spiritual journey, but has also shaped my work. I've only talked about my research, but you've also helped transform my teaching by making me a better listener. The closing song, Swimming to the Other Side, which I learned right here in this space, is part of a short playlist I used to listen to on the way to classes as a reminder that everyone in that room had their own struggles. Wo Ya Ya and Come and Go With Me are both about journeys, not solitary journeys, but human caravans, because you have been with me on mine, and I've joined you on yours. Instead of that book for fashion historians, I wrote a book for people who care about justice. And then another, and now I'm working on a third. So you see, the relationship between my work and my spiritual life is absolutely synergistic. There's a word for when beliefs and actions merge into a single path: integrity. I am so grateful to this community, to each and every one of you, for helping me find that path. Thank you.